The door stands open. Across lines, invisible hands are held, golden streamers building in the night. Alone, the possibilities are enormous. Step outside, and parasites, deprived of their meat, wait to suck on tiring flesh. Unending statistics that fatten leaders, prisoners of their morality. Afraid of death, we cannot save ourselves. To breathe is not enough.
So this sort of, you know, by the time I'd sort of left school, I was just determined not to work. So at that time, you know, if you didn't go to university, you weren't of the sort of class that went to university, you could, you know, move into sort of big collective houses, which is what we did. You know, you have a few years finding yourself being in a band and claiming benefits.
Does that mean you could get 40 quid a week to form a band, job seekers?
Well, it was at the time, which is interesting, it was to do with your surname. So it was like alphabeticised. So, you know, if your surname was W, you know, you'd sign on a Wednesday. You know, if your surname began with A, you'd be on a Monday. So we were able, basically, to live, you know, for quite a few years, collectivising our benefits. You know, your gyro would arrive on a Wednesday or something.
Don't worry, there's another one coming tomorrow.
Yeah, and, you know, let's all go to the pub or something like that. So I had a, you know, good quality of life for some, you know, for a couple of years doing nothing, you know, consciously avoiding work.
Tonight, you are going to hear music you never heard before. Tonight, you are going to hear the most cantankerous, roughneck, poisonous subplot you ever heard!
Arts Centre in Cambridgeshire, where we've been producing the third instalment of The Doll Show.
This is the third in the Welfare to Artwork series, which looks at the doll and the legacy of the welfare state and its impact on arts, music and cultural production in the UK.
So we ended the last episode in haste, thinking that we'd be in 97 with Tony Blair at the helm, but it seems we skipped ahead of ourselves. This show will be looking at the period from the late 80s into the 90s, when the beginnings of a shifting approach to welfare policy combined with changes to UK law meant that opting out of mainstream society to lead an alternative lifestyle was becoming increasingly difficult, and forms of peaceful protest, recreation and resistance had become criminalised.
We'll also be including some sections from an interview we did with experimental musician and sound artist Stephen Mallander earlier this month,
where we asked him about his experience of growing up in Sheffield, his relationship with making music at that time, and also about the kind of community he was surrounded by.
And ended up discussing the fundamental changes that have been implemented recently in slower and more insidious ways to threaten our collective creativity and freedoms today.
Thank you. With unemployment falling, it became easier for the state to make the benefit system more punitive. The changes in 1987 and 1988 certainly increased the disciplining role of the welfare state, thereby throwing down a gauntlet to the lifestyle of work rejection. Benefits for 16 and 17-year-olds were scrapped in favour of an extension of YTS slave labour, thereby removing the possibility of work avoidance, except by begging, for the young school leavers who had always been central to the movement. The introduction of the job training scheme and the availability for work requirements also had an effect. Restart interviews were easy enough for most people sufficiently clued up to blag their way through, but tended to encourage people to rely on their own wits. Because these changes were ultimately divisive, they encouraged people to look after number one. Attempts to organise against them were met with responses that expressed a distinct lack of solidarity, and this reflected not only the nature of the attack, but also the divisions that had emerged within the scene.
It was a strange time, wasn't it, that in terms of the music that was around, because there were lots of different music styles. Oh, at the same time, I can't imagine what was on Top of the Pops alongside you that night, but there was probably some weird variety of music, wasn't there?
All kinds of things, yeah. You've got to remember that it's a subculture. Two-tone is a subculture. But lots of different other subcultures, like punks, like mods, like soul boys, all of those people, all came under that umbrella and came along to our shows.
Incredibly interesting. So you're saying that you got a lot of your politics from Jarvis Cocker. So the death of popular culture, as well as the over-conceptualism of a lot of contemporary art, might have something to do with it as well, and the decline of a lively debate about art and politics. It's almost like saying, no, and then it's important not to have a kind of nostalgia for the 1980s and for, you know, that's another kind of trap to fall into. And, I mean, of course, the materialist argument there is the one that really kick-started our work in the creative industries, which is that when young people were able to be on the dole in Glasgow, they produced better music than they have ever done since. So, and they could read, you know, they could sit in the pub and read, and so, but that's not an argument, of course, for a mass unemployment. It's an argument for a better way of dealing with underemployment and the modern work society.
Oh,
complicated time, innit? Fragmentation of anarcho-punk. This contradiction partially explains the subsequent fragmentation and decline of the anarcho-punk squatting and travelling movement. On the one hand, the state relaxed credit restrictions, abandoning tight monetary policy, producing the credit-fueled boom which preceded the 1987 stock market crash. This led to a rapid fall in the number of jobless. Many previously involved with organising in and around the squatting scene got jobs during the boom, and whilst many remained living in squats to stay with friends and to save on rent, momentum was being lost. Individualism tended to replace a collective approach to social problems, as wage earners and dealers could afford to accept the position money held within the scene. The carrot of the boom, however, would not have had the same impact without the repeated blows with the stick of state repression.
We're inside a cave that's a natural cave. It's really lovely, it's just like the Flintstones, and they're doing a raid in a cave.
I was just going to say, we were talking about this a little bit the other day while we were thinking about the rave movement in the UK and what it kind of meant, why it was so important. And obviously it's reflected on a lot, you know, especially by artists. But yeah, I guess what we were thinking about was doing this research into the Dole and some of the interviews that we've been doing with Jimmy and Alana on the last show and also with Mal on this one. It kind of put into a lot more context what that kind of energy was coming out as a reaction to, especially given that, you know, the 80s have just seen this rising, the power that the music industry has taken on as a huge economic and cultural force, the kind of splintering out of all sorts of niche subcultures and the tribalism that came with the expression of people's identity through subculture, and also the negativity that people had to, that young people had to live with on a daily basis due to Thatcher's, what some could be described as a kind of assault on the young and on the poor. It all reached an apex in rave coming as what I imagine was a sort of quite radical and huge breath of fresh air and a real release, because it was counter to so much of that. It was coming together of different subcultures. It was like a very broad mass movement with a big working class dimension to it, and also taking from all these different areas of youth culture, really, and sort of creating a space that was very accepting through the use of drugs. And also the way that people were kind of already, there'd been subcultures where people were moving out onto the land, out of the cities, like the different waves of the travellers movement, but that really took on a different significance when there was huge mass gatherings starting to happen. Yeah, so that's kind of what we were thinking about.
Crime.
The recession of the early 1990s has seen youth unemployment shoot up rapidly, however, and with it the need for a lifestyle compatible with being skint. It has enabled the development of the eco-warriors that have so infuriated the government through taking anti-road protests beyond NIMBYism. But alongside clauses seeking to effectively criminalise anti-road actions, squatting, travelling and hunt sabotage, the CJ and the POA also contains clauses specifically aimed at raves, in order to understand why it is necessary to consider the events of 1992, events that left landowners, police and MPs demanding action.
Now, there were perfectly happy and well-organised free festivals at Stonehenge, for example, up until the mid-1980s, and they were suddenly banned.
This place should be open to the public on Midsummer's Day and all spiritual occasions, like the equinoxes and the two solstices. It's a very important spiritual place for this planet. Every Midsummer's, there was always this 1,000 locals that would turn up and hang out, usually after the pubs, you know, come out and watch the druids and all that, you know. Eventually it got so big, I think the government started thinking, oh my God, this is getting massive. What can we do? Stop it.
There really is some obligation on the government to identify some of the large areas of derelict land to provide alternative sites for festivals. You know, the hardcore areas on airfields, disused airfields in southern England, for example, of which there are many, many amount.
Politically or trying to fight a new piece of legislation. I was just having some fun with some mates, putting on a party for other people. And now here I am organising, taking part in helping out with the Advanced Party and what it stands for.
Truth and justice.
And at the same time, I suppose it's about the mid-90s, you know, I began to get involved or interested in sort of countercultural sort of stuff like free parties, raves and things like that, which are happening up and down the country. And this, so me and my mates would go out and attend these at the weekends, and towards the end, sort of mid-90s, these started to be increasingly attacked by the police. So there was a genuine sort of, you know, sort of antagonism there. And, you know, then Michael Howard brought out the Criminal Justice Bill, the 1994 Criminal Justice Bill and Public Order Act, which, you know, basically brought a lot of very disparate groups together.
Yeah, united a lot of people and brought a lot of disparate groups
together. Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, they were the seeds of, I suppose, the sort of beginnings of the anti-capitalist sort of alter-globalisation movement were sort of same there. So you had sort of like traveller groups, you know, that was New Age travellers as well as sort of traditional travellers who were under attack. You had squatters under attack, hunt sabs and people like that. So just by attending parties, you began to meet a sort of, you know, wider range of people who had sort of some sort of politic.
And did that lead on to taking part in some of the big anti-criminal justice bill demonstrations in London?
Yeah, well, it did. I mean, we used to go up and attend them. And, I mean, again, at the time, my politics weren't really formed. I hadn't done a lot of reading around politics, and, you know, I suppose in the home it was sort of working class conservatism, you know, like with a small C. And politics weren't really discussed, so when we went up and went along these things, I was just completely blown away by the fact that these people were organised. I just couldn't work out how they got together, you know, where would you make inroads to meet these people?
They were organised anarchists.
Yeah, exactly. So I remember the Hyde Park demonstration, particularly the one that kicked off, where there was a big sort of riot. And I managed to sort of go up to the front with my mate, who unfortunately got nicked. But when we were there, it was just like, I just couldn't believe it. You know, these people are fighting back, and it really did have a profound effect and sort of completely altered my understanding of how the world worked in the sense that you could fight back.
The government's criminal justice bill has ended in a riot in central London. Demonstrators threw missiles and CS gas at the police, and the bus stand was demolished by some police.
Yeah.
Section 5 of the Criminal Justice Bill is not just aimed at curbing parties and festivals. It also introduces criminal provisions against a whole range of other groups, including travellers, squatters, and those involved in peaceful protest.
All government is wrong.
The real problem being in this country that there's no constitution, there's no Bill of Rights, there's no backstop which prevents governments from continuously eroding the rights that people have. Part of me is amazed that they should proceed with such draconian legislation. The purpose is to criminalise whole parts of the community. It is in purpose exclusive. What the government need, I think, is an enemy within. They want a target group, and they want to appear to be tough in relation to law and order. The result will be that they will spend vast amounts of money policing the activities of people which have hitherto probably been lawful.
It really came out of the mind of Michael Howard, the current Home Secretary. And it's a collection of prejudices, really, a collection of saloon, you know, it's as if he went to the saloon bar door, threw it open and said, what do you think we should do about criminals? And people in groups in society we don't like very much. And he simply wrote down this collected farrago of prejudice and misinformation in one piece of legislation, which, as it stands, is probably the broadest, most comprehensive attack on civil liberties in this country since the Second World War. So,
around 8 o'clock last night.
Instructions to the officers were to arrest the people to prevent a breach of the peace. Serious breach of the peace.
I'm not.
Obviously, another thing that we've been really reflecting on at the moment is thinking about something like the Criminal Justice Bill. The rave scene generated a kind of excuse to clamp down on all of these people living on the fringe of society in a variety of different areas that the Conservative government at the time had been looking for an excuse to clamp down on, really. But there's obviously, at the moment, with the threat to people's civil liberties that's happening around the COVID-19 situation, obviously with good reason, and you know, the government's handled it appallingly, as we all know. But yeah, it's a huge concern that this will be taken as an excuse to do the very same thing in today's moment. So yeah, even just reading about this era, you just realise that the threat that we're faced with now around the prevention and the increased criminalising of people organising group gatherings, it's just quite sad and quite worrying to think about.
While the rave scene may have permitted the opening up of a new area for commercial activity, it has not been one that established capital has been able to fully penetrate. And this is not just due to the illegality of the drugs industry, which has unprecedented cultural importance to rave. Surplus value has instead been largely distributed amongst a new generation of petty entrepreneurs, from dealers to DJs and home growers to laser operators. And whilst nightclub owners have benefited from police repression of illegal parties, established interests in the brewing and music industries have been worried by the impenetrability of the rave scene for their products. As much of the money circulating in the rave scene becomes siphoned off by DJs and owners of sound systems and light shows, often to supplement their dole at the expense of it being spent on records and CDs. The MTV-promoted grunge phenomenon has been needed to help maintain the level of the music industry's commodity capital consumed by the youth market.
New age travelers.
For their victims.
This food is amazing. The beautiful girl fronting the white policeman. You can lip read her words as she gets shoved by a shield from another white officer. It's like watching the pre-Raphaelite Elizabeth Siddal meeting the harsh forces of the British government bi-party system. The music is apt, written for this time when the Criminal Justice Bill was about to literally make the creativity of art, music and culture of Britain extinct. The media called these kids the great unwashed, continuing to smear this generation. I remember going to all these demos and events feeling like future generations will suffer as a consequence of this bill. Today there has not been an art, music, culture or movement that stands out for two decades since the turn of the century. The last music scene Great Britain had was D&B, ragga, jungle, and that is basically what grime and drill kids are seeing as underground in current times in 2019. This is filmed in 1994. It's as if we've been in a time warp. They don't even know the freedom we had to party in fields, mansions, houses with freedom to express without being in a department at 50k by the time of 24. The freedom of having an education that is now only available to those who can afford it. Today we have the same tension of Brexit and universal credit, making laws, bills and sanctions on the good people of this beautiful country. I honestly think the powers that be despise the people of this country. The Britain seen in this video is not possible today, as the dumbing down of the past two generations has left them uninspired and divided. The day they put the Criminal Justice Bill in order is the day, literally, the music died.
I'm a bubble man. I am the bubble man. I am politician man. When you're starving, when you're striking, you see me on the TV, telling you how your selfish greed always fucks you up. I'm the bubble man. I am the bubble man. Say something in your own defense. You always sound so stupid and funny. You were never taught at school how to speak or think. Blow the show, blow the whole show. Blow the show, blow the whole show. Blow the show, blow the whole show. I push the button, push the button, push the button now. Still sitting in your classroom, listen to your teacher. I'm the bubble man. I steal your dreams and sell them back to you. I'm the bubble man. I'll sell you arms so your children lose theirs. And I'm laughing. I'm creating a famine and lawlessness to drive you insane. I'll blow the show, I'll blow the hoop show. I'll blow the show, I'll blow the hoop show. Press the button now, press the button.
So now we're going to include a few sections from an interview that we did with Stephen Mallander earlier this month in Brighton. We ended up chatting for a really long time, so we're not going to have space to include the whole thing. But if you want to listen to the interview in full, you can download it at our website, www.freecash.zone/welfare to art.
Yeah, there isn't like the same kind of mode of operation anymore or something. I don't know.
Well, there is, the infrastructure's changed. I mean, the thing with music, and it's not unfamiliar to a lot of creative
you know, areas of creative kind of pursuit, and that is that the ad, you know, the exchange value now has disappeared. There is no exchange value hardly in music. You know, you, before you would buy, you know, a 7-inch record or a CD, and it had, you would buy it, it would have an exchange value. It's got, that has gone because it's become intangible. It's also become incredibly available. Music starts to become more like a utility that people treat. It's like electricity or the tap, you know, you turn it on. You want some, you want to hear some music, you can just turn it on. You just put Spotify on, which is kind of the same as, you know, turning your telly on or turning your tap on or running a bath. So it's become that. So therefore, the exchange value's gone. So I think it's the hardest part about it, because I don't fully believe this argument, even though I'm going to say it, and that is music is part of its value, and maybe we should see it this way in a changing world. It's in its added value. It's in what it gives you, what we have. I can't remember the name of the person who said it, but it comes from the idea of music in, which is basically music is no longer a noun. It's not a thing. It's a verb. It's something we do. Mm-hmm. So therefore, it's the process that we get out of it. But I don't really like that, because I also see people making music and not really getting the just desserts that they should have, you know. And it's interesting that you're talking about class. It's, and again, it's not specific to music. It is about the arts. And I know, because I work down at an art college, and it's reached the point where only people who are wealthy enough can do art. 100%. You know, so therefore, it does tend to be, not always, and there are people, you know, I'm not generalising, certainly not generalising about class, but generally as a cohort, it's not that much of an option unless you're in a rather secure financially, or you have, you know, in your case, for example, you want to do this, this is massively part of you, and whatever happens, you have to do it. So it's not, you know, it's an essential part of a lot of different type of music. So, I was a soul boy, and that's where I, you know, that's my whole sort of history, has been soul boy when I was a teenager, or when I was really young, you know. So, you know, that was my connection with music, and it was through records. And, you know, the inspiration came from a mediated source, not from an actual source. So that's what inspired us to do it. And the same for all three of us. Richard was the same. He was a worker, you know, his dad worked in the steelworks. He was in the Communist Party. Chris Watson, who was the third member of the band, wasn't kind of from the working class bit, but he was just a regular kind of, you know, guy. And none of us had any history in music. Chris was a telephone engineer when we started. So we came from that working kind of way, really. And that's how we started. But the idea of a career was, no, that was never ever a consideration, because you did music because you wanted to. It was, you know, we never thought that we'd ever do. And it was also very arts-based. We were inspired more by art movements than we were by bands in that sense. Hence, we took the name, you know, from the Dadaist movement, really, because we were inspired by that idea of creating and making things as a way, not in opposition to the kind of the norm or the dominant thing, but in some ways an alternative, as a different form, and using art. We were into art and music as provocation, not entertainment, or, you know, it was provocation. Our early days were pure provocation, really, which was where we came from, really. So that was the background to us actually making music, how we started. And also, we weren't really interested in doing live music. We just liked the idea of experimenting with sound. So it's tape recorders and really early EMS synths and things like that. So our inspiration came from a slightly arty, slightly techie side.
Was that all that equipment like readily available, like the drum machines or the pedal, like how was it easy to get hold of?
No, not really. The only thing that was available that was readily available and cheap, and we did have a number of them, were tape recorders, really, and then also stuff that we buy from junk shops. You know, we buy guitar, and you know, both Richard's guitar and my first bass were from a junk shop, you know, and you know, things like that. It was just what was around. But then the idea of processing sound was a way of making electronic music without. I mean, the thing is, when we started, I'm saying without using synths, but synths didn't exist as such, really. I mean, you know, Robert Moog was starting to build the Moog, but our idea of a synth didn't have keyboards. It was more a piece of electronic music, so electronic equipment rather. So the music came from it wasn't the sounds that came from it weren't inherently musical. They were just electronic sounds. So we saw ourselves as just experimenting with sound, which wasn't something that we thought you could even translate in that much to say. But we did do some really early gigs with tape recorders, and we made films and used film loops, and we were part of a kind of respectable music society in Sheffield, but we were like the enfant terrible, and we actually got thrown out because we did a gig once at the university where we were really drunk and we started abusing the audience, and these were all people in velvet jackets with glasses of Chardonnay and all this kind of stuff who came to hear sort of like proper composition, you know, and we were just, but that was it. It was great. If they were a lot easier to provoke than anyone else, and they weren't going to attack us, and they threw us out and wouldn't let us back in, and we did one gig. But yeah, so we were part of, we were complete square pegs in there, and we didn't fit with the idea of popular music. We didn't fit in with any idea of sort of serious compositional music either. And we weren't coming strictly from an art space. We were coming from all these different places at once, but sound was something that was worked as a way of articulating some of that stuff and being a provocation as well. So that's how we started in those early days. So that's kind of the early 70 period, really, before we started playing. First gig, I think,
was just made me think about how what it is to be inspired by something or influenced by something, or in terms of creativity, how that looks different now, or how it's kind of, because music is so available, and with all these kind of algorithms kind of predicting what we will like. I don't know, I feel like maybe in the past, like your encounter with music might just be fundamentally different. So you could hear something that you didn't know or was unfamiliar, and then kind of have a reaction to it. The way you process it and then kind of find it inspiring might be different to how, but it just seems kind of quite fundamentally different to how people act around music now, or how people make music now.
Well, I mean, I think we've reached a point where there is nothing new. I don't think there ever will be. All that changes is the context, and so it's about recontextualization. It's the same bits, it's just how they're put together in a different way sometimes, but it's they're all made up of the same. So I'm at a loss to sort of answer that as well, really, to be quite honest with you. But, you know, part of that's been brought on by technology as well, in the sense that, you know, the fact that you can make music digitally, and you can sample, and you can, you know, integrate the past in with the present. So it all becomes very, very kind of, just becomes recontextualised, really. And that sampling's part of that. It's part of digital cultural time, just kind of loops around on itself, really, and changes slightly each time it goes around. You know what you were saying before, Ruth? The thing is that this is kind of the work of the devil, because it's what we've done is we've mortgaged everything. You know, we've mortgaged our freedom for this, in the sense that this appears to give us so much access to everything and make life so direct and complicated, whether it's from banking or sending a message or buying something. But, you know, but the truth is they're anchors, because, you know, everything goes through that. It's a, you know, it's a sort of an interface to the world. You know, I'm no different from anybody else, that, you know, everything does go through this, and you were constantly on it. But it's starting to worry me, because they've become sort of synonymous with everything we do in life. It's inseparable, rather, from everything we do in life. And that's really worrying when, you know, everything we do relies on that one thing. And again, equally, that one thing is something that other people are making profits out of. You know, I'm hoping we can reach the point where that becomes superficial, really. That's the only thing that will change us, to be quite honest. I know it won't happen, but we love the tools and we love what we can do, and, you know, it's brilliant, but at the same time, it's kind of worrying. You know?
Yeah.
It's kind of worrying, because we just live in this kind of weird simulated Ersatz world, really. You know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a real world we live in anymore. You know? And that's the difference, I suppose, that I was lucky that I did have a life before that came in. That's nice to know the different side of it. I mean,
we're the last generation to
Have some awareness of what it was like before technology took over. Like,
Sculptures generation. I'm unexcited. Like, I'm something about like what music and culture's reaction is to this. Like, what's the rallying sound? Like, how is this rage, anger, like provocation, disarmament, re-instrumentalization? Like, all these things. Like, I really wonder if music, given the kind of overly social mediatized space that we live in, whatever, like, what its response will be. You know, I'm really excited. Like, I don't know. Am I really excited?
Well, being hard, because there's no. Yeah,
I'm curious.
I'm curious.
Yeah,
if you think about like current music trends or like things, you know, about drill and stuff.
Also, like, even thinking about kind of things like in Sheffield now, there seems to be like a really interesting free party scene and stuff like that. Like,
they're getting hard.
And it's like, are those people, maybe they're having parties now, because we wouldn't know. And you're not allowed to, but you're not allowed to anyway. So it's open air. So maybe it's, you know, it's kind of, it'd be interesting to see. I don't know. I suppose it's like, will we even know about what some of the reactions to this moment are in terms of music?
But even like in The Guardian and the Observer on the weekend, it was the rave face but with a sad face, and it was like, the raves are coming back, watch out, these kids, they're just fucking shitting everywhere, listening to, they've made so much money they left their PA behind. It's kind of crazy, like, fear-mongering, like, before it's even started. It's like four crazy parties that are probably gonna happen anyway at some point, but like that's, you know, that's like, it's bad, stop the youth doing this, like, And it's funny, like, the references, like rave, the emancipation.
It is, yeah. I mean, the thing is that people want to do stuff. You can't stop people doing stuff. You know, I can understand certain fears of it, but it's like, oh, good God, you know, people went to a field and got off the reds. It's like, I worry about the kind of, you know, the health and the pandemic side of it. But other than that, you just go, people have been doing this for decades, you know? It's like...
Some big stones up down the road.
Yeah, it's like, people want to do this. People need to do it. So, you know, they're always going to be... And the fact that it's not entirely legal adds a certain frisson to it anyway, so we all love it. So, you know what I mean? Good God, so... So, I don't know, in terms of where music's going to go, the thing is, we're talking about music, the types of music we're talking about, you know, because you mentioned drill, and obviously, the thing is that represents a kind of a particular community, a particular kind of group of people often. I mean, obviously, even, you know, in some respects, it's kind of like, you know, it's sort of even regional, you know. So it has to represent something, and that's where it's a bit unclear. Punk represented a particular generation within certain inner cities, you know, the same with some of the, you know, the house stuff that happened. You know, reggae and dub represented those black communities. Drill does. So it's the only way the music is going to make sense, and what it's going to do is if it's a voice for something. At the moment, most music that we hear is just kind of like the bleating of a, you know, a mixed up. Well, you know, I mean, it's just music. It's turning on the tap. It doesn't mean anything. It's just background noise. You know, it's just pure. It's pure sort of, you know, sort of distraction rather. Whereas the music that you're talking about that has sense, it has to sort of be a voice and represent something or someone. I think that's why drill is, really, whether you like, you know, the violent kind of stuff. The point is, there is a connection between the people who make it and the people who hear it and the people who kind of do it. It is the voice of something, you know. A load of the stuff that you hear on, you know, that we hear on the radio, whatever, it has to represent something. So it's going to be how we come out of this and how people work as communities. So the rave thing, whether people are up in arms about it or not, It is the kind of like the beginning of people being drawn together to something specific, you know. So I don't know. Maybe that's what will happen. I get the feeling we're going to move into a period of kind of civil social unrest, and I think that's when it will perhaps start to represent something.
Yeah, and I'm really excited about
it. Can't exist in its own right. It has to be connected.
Where it is now, which is kind of it's not available to everyone anymore, and it's changed a lot, but.
It's kind of like it was agitated at some sense, at some point. The kinds of batons were carried off, and people were always a bit sceptical about the kind of class relations and race relations in the system. They kind of got a little bit unchecked for a bit, but still, like, agitated. And now it's kind of settled, sedimented, and it's gone, you know, and it's like...
The section of your thesis that you sent, it's really, I don't know, it's really nice to think about how the kind of history of a city and the material relative to people's lives kind of actually affects their approach to making music and... It's really interesting thinking about that in relation to now.
Yeah, it's. I mean, that's the massive difference and the reason. I mean, and it relates to your idea of kind of the welfare state and support. It's still attached to those regional sort of criteria and those regional things. And music at that time, and you know, in the sort of the punk period and post punk period, the cities and spaces where the music came from did define the music. You know, if you spoke to people, it was really funny actually. I was thinking about this earlier when you were going to be chatting. It's like one of the first. If you heard of someone, the first thing you wanted to know was where they were from, so how they may have a relationship with other things in that city. So, you know, Leeds had its own sound, Gang of Four and Mekons and things like that. Sheffield, it was also the Human League and, you know, Clock DDA. Manchester was obviously Joy Division and the Ratios. And cities started to define those kind of parameters. So it was very much based around that. And that is in part driven by the thing that, you know, you guys talking about in terms of there was a community sense of how you did it and very localized. So, you know, you probably ended up making music with people who in the first instance lived near you or went to school with you or, you know, in our case, in the very first case with Richard and myself, we met when we were 14 years old at football matches. We were, you know, we first met and a famous youth club called The Arc, which we met when we were about 14, 15 years old before we started making music. So there was a very tangible thing, but now obviously it's quite dispersed.
And I feel like we've actually not spoken that much about the Doll, but also we've exhausted that so much.
Well, the irony being is I was only ever on the Doll for 4 weeks. Although I was thinking about it because I knew we were going to be talking about it. The interesting thing was that I worked at the Steelworks and then I went to uni. And then when I finished, just as I finished uni, we just started to release music and bring stuff out. So And I was actually I was a gardener for when I left uni and when we first started making music. But then Richard and I both, we were making music more and it became more of a full-time thing. So we started, we earned enough money in the first EP and the first album, so we paid ourselves. But what we paid ourselves was the equivalent of the Dole. So we weren't on the Dole, but that was a subsistence thing. So we paid ourselves the equivalent of the Dole. It was slightly easy for us in the sense that because of the band money, we could pay for the studio out of the band money or bits of equipment. But our actual earning, our living, our earnings, we'll pay ourselves the equivalent of the Dole and then we'll see how long we last. Mm-hmm. And that way you also knew that if you fell, you weren't falling very far because you're that. Remember, it's not just the Dole. The other thing about Northern Cities, which is important, is that it's social housing. So that's for a lot of people living in council houses. Not everybody, but that again was part of it because it allowed loads of people, loads of bands in Sheffield all lived in, you know, around that period that was starting up in the sort of late 70s in the punk period. A lot of those bands were lived in council houses. Mm-hmm. Like Jarvis, yeah, I'm trying to remember which estate Jarvis lived on. But yeah, people lived in council houses. So it was just the Dole, it's about that social structure. It was about that the way it was, and the Dole was just part of that, yeah. Cheap bus fares, all that kind of stuff, you know. There was the whole kind of process that you could get through life without being completely broke, really.
Yeah, it's really good that you bring that up, actually, because it's not something that we really looked at, but even thinking about it now, like, quite a few of the artists that we know that are a bit older than us, a lot of them have just got council houses like in the 90s or in the 80s, and they've lived in them the whole until they're still in them, and they've made like quite good careers basically having affordable houses.
Loads of people did that, and you know, in Sheffield, things like Red Tape Studios, which came out of the council supporting. The other thing for Sheffield you've got to remember is it was a massively left-wing council, you know. Remember at the time I grew up through all that, I mean, it was, you know, the People's Republic of South Yorkshire. You know, we were so, because it was Thatcher, you know, we barely mentioned Thatcher, but, you know, a lot of northern cities were, you know, diametrically set up in opposition, and the councils at that point, until, you know, it was all changed and council power was eroded and finances, you had a central government, but you had local governments, which were very supportive and all very, very left-wing. All those big city councils were pretty much left-wing. I mean, David Blunkett was our head of Sheffield Council at the time when he was all right, you know, he was a good guy, and massively supportive of British steelworkers and mine workers. So we were lucky. We didn't feel abandoned. We felt that we had local governance that kind of understood us, so we didn't have a problem with that. Our only beef was with London and, you know, central government and Westminster, really. So we didn't feel probably what people do now, feel isolated. We just felt part of a, it's almost like a city resistance, you know, to those things. And it was the same in Manchester as well and in other big cities. We were kind of, the cities were resistant to central Westminster government and what they were doing, really, because they were eroding the manufacturing industry in Birmingham and Leeds, Sheffield, Manchester. They were eroding those primary industries. So there was a lot of resilience, even on a political level as well as on a kind of youth level. It was coming from different areas as well. So it's a big part of it. So there were other factors at play, but it all knitted together in the sense that it was a, an understanding and supportive kind of network and framework that people were living in, and it developed those community things, really, you know.
Yeah.
So, loads of us didn't really like the idea of government handouts. It was always felt like a cop-out for us. We were always anti-grants, arts grants and things like that. I've never had a single grant in my life. And that's not, this might not sound bad for you guys because you've grown up in a different system and you need it. We didn't. We always felt that, sounds an awful thing to say, but at that time, we felt that any art that needed to be supported by funding wasn't valid, in the sense that we made art that was self-supporting. We were always self-supporting. So therefore, we felt what we were doing had validity. It was like, it has value. We don't need somebody to pay for us to make this. We will make this and we will make it effective and successful. And we did do, you know. So, and that's not the same now, because the thing is, because all that structure, all that support has gone, grants and arts council, I mean, I'm guessing you managed to get an arts council support grant. Yeah. Thank fuck for that, you know, so I'm not knocking it now, but if you think of it, from our point of view, at that time, it was like, oh, people who get arts council's grants are just tossers who don't use art. They think they're doing art, but no one's really bothered about it, and no one will pay for it, so they only exist because it's got a grant. I know that sounds really horrible, but we felt it gave us a certain air of authenticity, because our art stood up on its own and it paid for itself and it, you know, supported us as well. So we were a bit lucky. You can't do that now. It's a completely different world. But at that time, you know, it probably is worth mentioning, probably to my detriment to say these things, but it was very true, you know.
Yeah.
We helped people. We recorded local bands for fuck all. We raised loads of money to start the Leadmill, which is now a well-established, you know, venue in Britain. But that was run by a couple of two hippies who came and went, we found this old bus depot, we want to change it into this venue and art centre and all this kind of stuff. And but, you know, we got no money, and would you help do? And we did. We did a couple of fundraisers, and we raised money, and we got to get the whole thing started. So we weren't anti-community, we weren't anti-support, but when it came to ours, it was like, no, we don't need your help, we'll do it our way. Because we always felt that if somebody gave you money, it compromised what you were doing, because they had a say in what that was. Mm. We didn't. No one, no one ever told us what to do, because we were the only ones who fucking paid for it, you know. Yeah, so it was always meaningful to us. That doesn't exist so much now, but you always felt that your work was compromised because someone else had funded it and they had some investment in it and you didn't really want that.
Yeah.
Weird to think that now. It's weird to think that nowadays, I know, but it was how we felt.
Yeah. But it's true that it does affect the way that you make things and you, you do, when you, not with, with the recent emergency grants from the Arts Council, it's actually completely different because it's, you're not applying to make something and get money for that specific project. It's just like, I need money.
To live, yeah.
Yeah, it makes you think, I wish it was always like this.
Yeah.
But normally, applying for a grant to do it, it's like a slow, like, it's all very against what creativity actually feels like, where you have to plan loads.
It becomes bureaucratic. Right. I'm just talking about this particular period you're talking about, which was a completely different world, and there was no real funding for those things.
Yeah.
You had to do it yourself, but it was also a consideration on our part. But yeah, it's not. I have no problem with it, and thankful for it, and I know people, massive thanks also. I mean, I don't really have much to do with the Musicians Union, but, you know, I also know the Musicians Union support a lot of people that I know have managed to help them with loads of issues and things like that, and so the art, and the Arts Council. So I have no beef with them. And where anybody, this moment in time, where anybody can get money from, they'd go for it. That's cool, yeah. It's just, yeah. It was a different world in which I existed, so the, where that exchange rates for art and music still existed, you know, which it doesn't as much now. So you got to get where you can. So I have no problem with it at all. It was just worth mentioning in... I thought we'd better cover the thing you were talking about at the very end. So there you go. I've just done that in 10 minutes. I've covered all that for you. Yeah.
Thanks ever so much to Miles, Stephen Mallander.
You're a Don. Thanks for sharing your insights with us.
In Brighton, which you might be able to tell because you can hear the seagulls in the background through the whole recording, but that's quite nice. Obviously, massive thanks to everyone at Wising. We've been recording this episode of Welfare to Artwork out at Wising on residency here. It's been amazing spending some time out here and using all the brilliant equipment. Thanks to Montez, obviously. Yeah, so a couple of people have reached out to us after the last couple of shows, sent us some really nice articles or just really interesting thoughts on the show. So thanks in particular to Freya for sending a really thoughtful email.
She sent us a wonderful email that kind of problematised or like brought in housing co-ops and housing in general.
And also Paul Recrit, who he has a show on Resonance.
Everyone should check out his show. It's called Beholder Halfway. But he also put us on to the pivotal text for this episode, Kill or Chill, and you can find it on Libcom. And it's basically all about the criminal justice bill. Also, just wanted to add that at some point we'll be putting up a reading list with the videos and music and images that we've been looking at. And just to add, all three episodes of Free Cash will be available on freecash.zone/welfare-to-art, and we'll also be adding the complete Stephen Mallander interview as well. We're not sure what the next episode will be about, but maybe
we'll finally end up disemboweling Tony Blair like Adam promised on the last episode.
If anybody wants to get in touch, if there's any suggestions for anything we should look at or anything that you want to ask us, please email us at info@freecash.zone.
Thanks, Wising. Thanks, Montez.
See ya.
See you next time.
You're listening to Free Cash Radio.
Nah, 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 nah.